G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Andy Balburnie's just brought up his ton for Ireland. That's good news, and I'm sure Adam White's watching every single ball because it's what he does. Whitey, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Daniel. It is quite extraordinary. Obviously, England has already won the series because they won the first two matches. So, but this is quite remarkable. Well, there is that dead rubber factor to it, but there's also the history attached to it for Ireland to defeat England in a one-day international in England is of real significance.
Has
and
it ever happened?
I don't think it has. I stand to be corrected there, but I'm pretty sure it hasn't. I don't like the fact that the Ireland batsman is wearing blue pads with his green gear. That annoys me a bit.
What is
anyway,
that?
There's going to be a run out here. But, So the big partnership's going to be ended with Tom Curran running out one of the batsmen. I think it's...
Not Balburnie, it's the other one.
Yeah, Sterling.
Sterling. It's Sterling, okay.
Yeah. But I think these are the sorts of things where, and I know we're in the time we're in, but it's just so disappointing that we're going to see this massive upset and there's no one there to watch it. Now, it's obviously a big TV event and all these sorts of things, and it doesn't change the result, but it is a shame that we're seeing, potentially, they still need 65 or 50 balls, potentially we're going to see a historical moment in sport, particularly in cricket, and there's just no one there.
Ireland beat England in the 2011 World Cup.
Did you go.
They did. 7 for 329. They defeated England 8 for 327. What did England make today? They must have made a similar score. Kevin O'Brien.
320. Oh, that's right. That was at Lord's, wasn't it?
Stand by. I'll find that for you. It was certainly somewhere.
Anyway, probably should have started the show. Can we start the show again?
No.
We did not know that. Anyway.
Oh, we're on fire.
But the good thing is that we've got a situation where there is some live sport happening and sort of breaking news to wake up to. And I talked about this the other day, that for a couple of months, there was just nothing going on overnight across the world. But we've got a one-day international live at the moment between Ireland and England. The championship playoff game's currently underway in England as well for that last spot in the Premier League between Brentford and Fulham. And after 64 minutes, it's 0-0. So there's plenty of...
Stress.
Yes, plenty of stress around that. And then the news that you touched on before with Rafa Nadal pulling out of the US Open and with Federer already out, you just wonder whether it's worth actually having the event. I'm sure they will have it, but that's a big blow to the tournament as well, because there's others not playing as well. It's not just the fact that Nadal's not there and Federer. You just wonder whether it's going to take place. We talked about Ash Barty last week. Interesting times.
Well, let's try and get a hold of Craig Gabriel and go a bit deeper into that dive of conversation for the tennis and see what he thinks about all that. Just on that that game in 2011 for the World Cup, it was in Bengaluru. It was a Group B game, a day-night affair, and England made 8 for 327. Today, they made 328. There you go.
Certainly wasn't at Lord's.
So they like to chase, is what we're hearing from Ireland today. They chased it down in 42 overs last time. That's a good effort. It is a very good effort.
Yeah.
So they need 63 and 48 balls.
It's really good for cricket that these things happen because, you know how big I was on the World Cup last time where they didn't have very many countries participating in the World Cup. And that wasn't really what the World Cup's all about. It's about growing the game and having a situation where new countries can come through and actually, create greater depth in world cricket, expose them to this sort of tournament. And yeah, you'll have some one-sided results, but it's about the celebration of cricket. These are the sorts of things that I think are important to the development of the game. Now, I know that one of Ireland's key new players is a South African.
He represented Ireland.
He represented Ireland, having never stepped foot on the country.
Perfect.
I think. But I think these are the sorts of things that the cricket needs. So it's good. And when England's involved, it's even better.
We need more South Africans playing for other countries, is what you're saying?
No, we need England being beaten by minnows.
And they're not minnows anymore. We've been on the Irish wagon for a couple of years here on the Breakfast Club. They're not minnows. They've had good victories. They've played good test cricket of recent years. And clearly they're building and they're getting stronger and stronger. I have to pinch a few South Africans, that's okay. Everyone does.
Yeah.
Everyone does. In the trade period, like they're the team that everyone just tries to just rip apart, the South Africans, because there's always seemingly one or two that just can't get a game, so we'll take them. Good depth chart.
Absolutely. I've often talked about this with my mates. If you had a trade period in cricket, the one country that you would really put a lot of time into, I think, is Pakistan, because they have a lot of players that represent their country and then disappear. And you just think that you could cherry pick off Pakistan and get a diamond in the rough for a third round draft pick or something like that, just to especially if there was a mystery spinner involved, Daniel,
or
a wristy top order batsman. But we shouldn't talk, as the text message reminds us, we shouldn't talk like Ireland have definitely won, because they've still got a 61 off 44 balls. That still has to happen.
Yeah, we're still on the wagon, though. We're cheering them home. But as also picked up off the SMS, the Irish, the English captain, made 100. He's Irish. Is he Irish?
He is, and he absolutely is Irish.
Yeah, that's right. So I wonder how he feels about all this. I imagine he would like to represent his country. Wouldn't he?
I don't know. I mean, it has been spoken about before. With him, obviously, for obvious reasons. But at the end of the day, now when you look at him, he is the captain of an English World Cup winning team.
That's only to keep him away from the Irish team. That's incentive. That's just one of those contract things. You can come to us and we'll make you captain. How about that?
Yeah, no, it is interesting. There's been a couple that have represented both England and Ireland. There's one guy, and I can't think of his name off the top of my head, a top water batsman, who played for England first and then played for Ireland. I can see him, I can't think of his name. But, the reality is that Ireland didn't really play a lot of international cricket, and Morgan was good enough to play a lot of international cricket for England, both test matches and particularly one-day games.
Yes, he's a pretty good player. He is Owen. He's doing good things. Very nice things. So we'll congratulate him on his excellence. Absolutely. Yes, Owen Morgan, 106 for him today as England captain. But the chase is on, and it's good fun. It's always good when you've got a chase and there's an underdog taking on a stronger country. And, of course, England, as you rightly say, Whitey, are the reigning World Cup champions. So they know what they're doing in this shorter format of the game. But we'll keep you abreast of that through the morning as well.
This is why we should have the quiz, because there's the question.
What's
the question? Who was the top order batsman for England, who then represented Ireland?
No, but you don't know the answer.
See, that's a good question.
But you don't know
answer. That's right.
So how can you have that question?
Because I would do my research and get the answer before I ask the question.
Right.
Which is unprofessional of me not to know that. Anyway.
Well, you're not doing a quiz, so you don't
find
know everything. It's okay. Now, did you watch the footy last night?
I did.
Were you inspired?
I did. Was I inspired? I was in admiration, I think would be the way I would describe it.
Right,
in admiration for how good Richmond was and how good they are playing, despite the fact that they are still having key players out of the team, despite the fact that they have players that are underdone. I just love the way that they play. And we've talked about this all the time about, and even just yesterday with Rodney Eade, the amount of teams that just play the same way, that Richmond don't play the same way as other teams, and they play a successful way, a very simplistic way, and it's a premiership way, and they keep doing it. And I thought, when Brisbane kicked the first two goals last night, I thought, oh, here we go. Well, they only kicked another two goals for the game. They kicked lots of points.
Lots of points.
But Richmond were just excellent, Daniel, and I just think that, if they're going to play like that, no one's going to beat them.
Well, I think... No, they were very good. I was very impressed with Richmond. I didn't think they'd be that clinical. This is the word for Richmond that I use, clinical. They're just clinical. It's not pretty, and it's not surgical clinician sort of stuff, but it's just clinical. They just play the same way every day. Although they did play a little bit differently last week to get themselves back into form and take away the Bulldog strengths. But they played a very strong brand of Richmond footy last night. It seemed to work really, really effectively. They did have a lot of the footy last night, which is not necessarily something they do week in, week out. Like, they almost had 300 disposals last night. And I hazard a guess that they wouldn't have hit 300 many times, certainly this year with the reduced time in the games. But it's their ability to get goals easily is what makes me impressed. They draw defenders out, they use the free player, that forward handball, but they just use the free option. It's a very simple plan a lot of the time. They just use the free option. Rather than trying to make something up or pull something out of a hat, they just do the easy thing really, really well, and so often it bears fruit for them. And that's what I get out of watching Richmond. They were brilliant. With their efficiency inside forward 50 last night and ability to hit the scoreboard when they got the opportunities. Because early in the game, it was all Brisbane. And then Richmond would go down and score. Brisbane owned the footy and owned the time in forward half and forward 50 sort of stuff. And have all those chances at goal, but they just didn't make the most of them. Now, 4-17 suggests, if you're the Brisbane Lions fan, that you're not losing hope. Although, geez, you'd want to sort that out because it was the same thing that happened in the final last year. And maybe the ghosts of... Yeah. of the final last year came to have a bit of a visit to the Brisbane Lions players. So they got plenty of looks, and if they can clean that up, this ended up to their eyeball still. But I think what we know about Richmond is that despite the fact that they haven't got the personnel, they play a brand of footy that is plug and play effectively, if they teach it correctly, which clearly they do. And it doesn't matter who's out there, they can be as dangerous as any team in the competition with half a side. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the key, Daniel, I was thinking about this last night with Richmond, and this is why I think, apart from the fact it's premiership-winning football, but a reason why we should celebrate it.
It's premiership-winning football at the moment, because no one can beat it, but they clearly own the game.
No, but they've won two of the last... Yeah, but they've won two of the last three premierships playing this way. Yeah. But what I like about it is that they move the ball quickly. They play on from marks... they have players ahead of the football generally. And last night we saw situations where, whether it was Lynch, whether it was Revolt, whether it was Martin, they had one-on-one looks inside 50 because they were prepared to move the ball quickly. And they spread the ground extremely well. And defences can't set up behind the ball when Richmond's moving the ball quickly. And I just think they were really good to watch last night. And it was quite ominous because I still think there's a lot of improvement to come with both personnel. So you've still got to put Prestia back in that team, Hooley, Edwards, potentially Nankervis. Asprey, does Asprey get back now with Noah Bolter playing so well? Lynch is going to get better as he was better last night, but he's still got that hand issue. You know, Jack Revolt's been out of form. He was a lot better last night. So... there's still scope for improvement. I think with Brisbane, while they did kick a lot of behinds last night, there's no question about that. I think 10 of them were snaps and there's a couple of rushed as well. They were a lot of kicks, Daniel, under pressure. And this is the thing I find with Brisbane is they got a bit unnerved and they have got a very young forward line in a lot of ways, especially their tall players. And I just worry about their lack of composure from their guys forward of the ball, particularly inside 50. Outside Charlie Cameron, there's just a lot of guys where you go, I'm not sure. Are they going to hold up in a final? Well, they didn't last year. That's going to be, a big talking point moving forward.
But I think it's all the more admirable from Brisbane that they're able to play and be as dominant with that forward line and the inexperience they've got in it.
Considering I agree.
Where they're going at the moment. Now, Richmond are they're different gravy, as Adam Collins might say. They're a bit different gravy because of their experience. You look at their forward line, it's just oozing experience. You mentioned Rewalt and Lynch last night and Dusty flowing down there and doing his thing. Like they've been 200 gamers, 250 gamers, those guys, and key pillars for just about all their career. So they get it, they understand it. Whereas the Brisbane forward line's very, very different. Link McCarthy impresses me too with what he's able to do. Missed a few shots he should have kicked last night, which would have been handy for the Brisbane Lions. But
he does.
There's scope for them. There's real scope for them. I'd be disappointed if I was Chris Fagan with their efficiency and their scoring. But I'd also be sitting there going, righto, okay. I didn't go away today, but we'll just bank that. We'll just put that on file because we've shown that again that we can. This is twice in a row we can get enough looks. It's just about how we finish it off now. We just need to work out a different system against the Richmond to finish it off and make it a bit easier for us. And I think they can do that.
The point you make about their inexperience in their forward line and just in general, this is a team that is I still think they're a genuine top four team, Brisbane. I think.
They're not a top four team.
I think. You got the likes of Ballenden, Skinner, Answorth, Payne, Stasevich. I'll throw in Ellis Yeoman, McInerney, Bailey. Gardner's probably a bit better than what I'm about to say. Archie. But they're a team of kind of no-names.
Emerging
but they
names.
Get the job done.
They're emerging names. This is the brilliance of Fakes and what he's doing, what he's building up there. That's why I admire him greatly. I agree with you.
But I'm saying, you look at that team, and you know how I keep talking about the Giants. You look at the Giants team, and you look at the names, and you look at their ability, and you stack that up against the Brisbane team, and you think, well, the Giants will win this by 100 points. But Brisbane beat the Giants, and when they played earlier in Sydney. So there's something magical about what Chris Fagan's been able to do with that list.
System and plan. You can teach. It's no different. Yeah. It's no different to Richmond. If you've got a system and plan, you can teach. It's really consistent and doesn't matter who it is. Now, obviously, talent plays a part. If you've got some talent on top of that, that's really helpful. But those players you mentioned have got real talent. We just don't know it yet. We just haven't seen that blossom into the mature talent that it will be in time. So there's no doubt those guys you mentioned have plenty in the tank. It's still emerging and working out who they are in the grand scheme of things at AFL level. So they'll be fine. It's just going to take some time before they, have 50, 60, 70 games before they really start to work out what they're capable of. It's even nicer to have the company of Craig Gabriel, who looks sharp. I can see him. Even though I can't see him, I have visions of how sharp he's looking in his crisp polo shirt that he's wearing today with maybe a knit over the shoulders. Craig, welcome.
You're right. It's actually the white Lacoste polo with the navy V-neck sweater.
See, I had visions of it, Craig. I have visions. I think about what you're wearing a lot.
There you go. The mark has been set.
Now, the big news in tennis, Craig, let's get to that. Rafa is out of the US Open. How long has it been since we've had a Grand Slam event without Rafa and Rog?
Without both of them, yeah, that's a good question. I can't think right at the top. I mean, I think the last time Rafa didn't play one of the majors was probably Wimbledon a few years ago because of one of his induced injuries. Yes, it's very disappointing not to have him there. Federer's out because of injury and withdrawn well before. But Rafa says the situation is very complicated worldwide with COVID-19 cases increasing, and it looks like we still don't have control of it. And he went on to say that this is a decision I never wanted to take, but I've decided to follow my heart and rather not travel. So I don't know what that means as far as the French Open is concerned, because he's still going to have to travel to Paris. Madrid has been cancelled. Will he go to Rome? Again, a matter of traveling as well, because he's at his place in Mallorca.
Could he drive?
Still traveling.
Yeah, I know, but if he's in a car rather than in a plane with lots of other people and having to go through airports, maybe he can just drive.
The thing is, if he's flying, he's going to go by a private plane to Paris or to Rome.
Or he
could take his new cruiser. Have you seen his new boat?
Oh, I have not.
Goodness gracious, it would put Britannia to shame.
Right, okay, I'm going to Google that. Stand by.
So do you think, Craig, there's a chance that the US Open won't happen at all? I mean, we talked last week, and I think you made a good point about, Serena and all these sorts of things, about trying to give her a chance to win a US Open. But we're starting to lose players, as was always, I guess, anticipated. Where do we think we're at the moment with it all?
I think they're going to go ahead. I think they will go ahead when you look at the entry field. Yes, I think there's still the definite potential of losing some more players. I was actually surprised to see Simona Halep on the entry list. On the women's side, 9 of the top 10 women are in. The exception is Ash Barty. And on the men's side, 7 of the top 10. The exceptions now, as we know, Rafa, Roger, and Gael Monfils out of the top 10 not playing. So we've got to wait and see. But I dare say that there will probably be another couple of players that will decide to pull out, but I think it will go ahead. I think we should just say one benefit for an Australian on the women's side, Lizette Cabrera from Townsville. She has now got straight into the main draw, even though she's ranked 127. So she's straight into the main draw of the US Open.
Well, that's good.
Right, okay.
For the Aussies, which is nice. What about the, so from the men's perspective, we've got Rafa and Roger. Who else is not going? Craig?
Stan Wawrinka is not going. We know Nick Kyrgios is also not going. Those are the main ones at this point. There are some of the lesser names that won't be going, but that's the way. The men's is not as well with those three names out. Is a little bit less on star power, if we can put it that way, compared to the women's.
I wonder if Ben Everill's from Druin. I don't know. But I know he's on the PGA Tour. He does great things at PGAtour.com. He's our man on the golfing circuit. He's joined us this morning. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, guys.
Yeah, where are you from, Ben?
I'm from Wollongong.
Wollongong.
Sydney. I'm a beach boy from way back. So that's where I applied my trade from a young age and before heading to Sydney to work and then over to the US for the last 12, 13 years.
Righto. Okay. From the gong. Everyone loves the gong. Nice work. We also love major championships in the world of golf. We've got our first one coming up this week at TPC Harding Park in a COVID environment. How's it all going in the build-up, Ben?
It's bizarre. It's bizarre to be here in a very small, much smaller media centre and with nobody else out on the grounds other than a handful of obviously players and their small entourage. But, you know, it is a major championship. It will go down in history books as such, and someone's got to win it. So these guys have got their game faces on.
So just paint the picture for us in terms of the normal proceedings and then what's available for the players in terms of warm-up facilities, protocols are in place that are a little bit different to perhaps a normal major championship.
Yeah, look, obviously the testing, just to even get in here, each player including staff and whatnot have to be tested for COVID before they can come in. Once they get the negative, we can come in on the ground. It's all sort of skeleton. There's the clubhouse and the locker room is set up with social distancing in mind, despite the fact that, you know, they've all sort of tested negative to be inside here. As I said, skeleton sort of media situation with maybe 40 tops, including PGA Championship, PGA of America staff and whatnot in the media scene, instead of hundreds. No state, no grandstands, nothing like that. No tents for hospitality or anything like that. We just got the skeleton crew of volunteers to sort of spot balls in the deep rough, and the rest of us are sort of just keeping at our distance and making sure that things go to plan, I suppose. There's no sort of vibe without a crowd, as you can imagine, and the big names have definitely been struggling with that since the return to golf, trying to get that sort of feel of it being a big week rather than a regular week or just day at your local muni, you know. But there is a sense of them trying to do that. I've been watching them do their practice rounds. A lot of guys trying to strut, trying to put that sort of that face on instead of the smiling we've seen in the last few weeks. But whether that plays out in competition, we'll have to wait and see.
I'm interested, Ben. We talked to Cam Percy yesterday about the shock and the uncomfortability about Brandon Grace testing positive to coronavirus. Has that unnerved anybody ahead of the major that it might happen in a major championship and who it might happen to, or has it sort of been pushed to the side a little bit?
Yeah, look, that's the sort of the elephant in the room and at the side of the room that everyone's hoping just sort of stays in the corner. Now, what happened to Gracie is terrible. Of course, he was obviously two rounds to go, and of course, testing positive is one thing and missing out is another. We just hope he's healthy first and foremost. But yeah, if that happens this weekend, and what if it happens before the final round? And what if it is the leader? What if it is Tiger Woods? Like it's something that we're obviously very hopeful won't happen. Now, you know, if everybody keeps to their protocols, it technically shouldn't happen. The voters said they all get tested, and they're in a bubble both here at the course where no one is in here that hasn't sort of gone through the protocol, and they're sort of told how to access the away from the course. They're not supposed to go into the community to eat. Everything's sort of at home and within that team and within your bubble. So a lot of Uber Eats, I suppose, and a lot of guys at this level have their own personal chefs in the houses that they rent and or hotel that they're in, which again has been put into a bubble.
Yes, now I find that really interesting. As you said, if it was a Tiger or a Dustin or one of the biggest names in the sport, I mean, if they were to get it, just the reverberations that would have in the sport, it's fascinating. Absolutely. And, Brandon Grace, Ben, he's a very, very good player. But, I mean, when he pulled out of that event last week, he's tied for second. I mean, it was extraordinary what happened. But the event kept going.
Yes, look, it also comes down to the contact tracing that they have to do immediately when there is someone that tests positive.
Yep.
Also, the fact that he was symptomatic versus asymptomatic. So yep. He actually didn't feel well, got a test, and was then positive. They did quick tracing to see who he'd seen since between the last negative and the positive. Were able to sort of pinpoint down anyone he'd been near or in contact with, make sure that there wasn't a threat to the wider tournament itself, and move forward from that. Now, if it's asymptomatic, then they can even ask potentially, for retesting and whatnot, although they're supposed to get two negatives within 48 hours, so that will force them out of the tournament itself anyway. However, all these sort of things that can happen in this scenario could happen. And look, I know that it's a potential thing there, but as I said, hopefully we can get through unscathed, and it's not an issue if everybody seems to do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, certainly an interesting time. The course itself and the forecast, is it supposed to be cold and wet this week?
Yeah, look, it's very cold, and the marine layer here makes sure that the mornings have got that fog and that chill to it. It has been that way the last couple of days. And in the afternoon yesterday, the wind really got strong, sort of what would have been late in the afternoon waves. Whether or not that happens here for the rest of the week, we don't know yet. But the cold mornings will definitely be a factor for the likes of Tiger with his back, and possibly even our boy Jason Day if he can't get it warmed up early enough. And the rough is pretty thick. It's just get a little bit of rain tomorrow, which will make it wet and juicy on the first round, which will be tough. But again, it's a short course, so guys can probably still just wail away, bomb it as far as they can, and get it from the rough with a wedge. So it's not as big of an issue.
Jason Day, if he gets an early morning tea time, Ben, he's going to need to chuck himself in the microwave at about 5 o'clock in the morning just to get warm.
Yeah, well, his first round is 7:38 local a.m. He's in the first, so he is off early. One of the first groups on the first day. He'll need to make sure he's warmed up, so to speak, as you said. And, we'll come no surprise to you guys with my advice or whatever, but I honestly think he's a huge chance to win this week. I've been closer than the last month, and he has been building for this week. So if he is healthy and able to get off to a decent start, look out.
We have a very, very, very special legend in the world of football. One of the all-time greats, in fact. 269 games in the brown and the gold, a five-time premiership player, three-time All-Australian, best and fairest, two-time Norm Smith medal, if you don't mind. Big game champion, Australian Football Hall of Fame member, Hawthorn Hall of Fame member, and a VFL premiership coach twice as long as coaching career. Amongst an unbelievable contribution to the game. And on this day, 1978, he made his debut for the Hawks. It is none other than Gary Ayres who joins us. Ayres, good morning.
Morning, Harf. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Very well. I like these moments where we can go back down memory lane and have a chat about special days in legends' careers. And this was one for you.
The 5th of August 1978, Ayrsie, you played your first game for the Hawks in the number 33 jumper, just by the way, and kicked three goals. Where'd you play?
Well, it was very, very good day all round, Huff, as you could well imagine when you get a call up for your first game. But I actually got a phone call on the Thursday night, and it was one of the very few phone calls that I got from the Hawthorn Match Committee to say that you played your first game. I think I'd only played about half a dozen reserve games, and I started on the interchange, and I actually was thrown into the midfield just before half-time, if my memory serves me correct, and then was able to snag one off the ground, mate, and of course then probably pretty lucky because I think I was only about 3 metres out anyway, and after half-time ended up just playing half-forward flank for the rest of the game, so it was a little bit all over the shop, but I'd originally come down from the country, from Warrigal, as a 17-year-old lad, and started off as a forward. And who would have known all those years later, half, that I would have ended up in the back pocket. So I probably thought you couldn't go too far back, mate, after that anyway, put it that way.
Yeah. So you're only 17. So you'd only been down there for 6 weeks, you were saying, from Warrigal.
Yes, I'd been invited down as a young lad for the pre-season of 77, leading into 78, and anyway, as things turned out, Hawthorn thought that I probably, because of my age, would have been preferable to start off in the under-19s, and my father and a couple of the Hawthorn Match Committee had a bit of a chat and said, well, the kid's playing senior footy back at Warrigal, he's against all the old dairy farmers and spud farmers, and of course, if the cows didn't milk on the day, they got a bit angry. And if the suds didn't run, they got a bit angry. So the old man said at the time, well, he might as well go back and play senior footy there. So anyway, Hawthorn, to their credit, just sort of kept tabs on me. And I came down, I can't quite remember the round, but we were playing out at Waverley and I was living in the country and it was a bit closer to travel. So I ended up playing in the seconds against Richmond on the Saturday. And then went back to Warrigal. It was a long weekend, played Warrigal on the Monday, and then the following Saturday played another reserve game. And from that point on, mate, so it was all a lot different back in those days.
That's amazing. And we often talk, Gary, about the likes of Michael Tuck and certainly Robert Diviadomenico that played a lot of reserves footy before they became a regular member of the Hawthorn senior team. And you were a bit the same. You played only 20-odd games in your first four seasons. So you were another one that had that foundation where you had to really earn your spot, I guess, before you got that regular position.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess when I came to the club in 78, they were pretty strong because they'd been obviously finalists and, of course, premierships throughout the early part of the 70s, and we were sort of starting off as a pretty young reserve side, and we happened to make the reserves grand final, and also to the seniors made the grand final, and of course subsequently went on and won the grand final / premiership. So yeah, it was about, I guess, doing an apprenticeship, learning the Hawthorn way, and being indoctrinated into all the culture and just how great a club Hawthorn were. And I guess in the early days, as I said, I come from the country. I was a 17-year-old lad. I didn't have a licence, so to get to training, I was living out at Springvale, and you had to catch the train to Malvern, and then I caught the tram, and I tell you what, down Glen Ferry Road, there's a lot of stops along the way to get to Glen Ferry Road.
There is.
And you'd be waiting for someone to give you a lift at the end of training, and it was a little bit like being, I guess, the naughty boy outside the headmaster's room at school. I used to sit there with my bag, and I used to get a lift home by Calvin Matthews. He lived in Noble Park, and as I said, I lived in Springvale. So, yeah, but a lot of the players did go on and have really good careers, and I guess that grounding and learning about Hawthorn made you become a better player, and I guess they made you wait to try and get your opportunity. I don't think they gifted you games back in those days at Hawthorn, and I would probably feel that makes you a more rounded player, makes you appreciate it a lot more. And, of course, then when your time finally comes, you want to certainly grab that opportunity and, hopefully stay in the senior side.
Gary, as a young 17-year-old coming to Melbourne from Warrigal, what was it that you spoke about the Hawthorn way? What was it that struck you about Hawthorn that made it such a special club in the coming years?
Just the competitiveness, the family-type club atmosphere, and I remember they were very, very good to my parents when we arrived on that particular day out at Footscray, and of course how they were inclusive and just, I guess, the respect that they had for the people within the Hawthorn Football Club. And also, too, we've got to remember that Hawthorn were a pretty ordinary unit when they first started back in the sort of early 20s, and I didn't play finals till about the late 50s. So you certainly were made aware that the club didn't want to go back to those old dark days. And, of course, you know, we had the revered figures of John Kennedy Sr., who certainly had spelled out previously what Hawthorn was about. And, of course, there were times where you'd listen to the older players about how they would lose a close game, and, of course, they would go back to Glenferrie Oval and there'd be someone on the piano, there'd be another one on the banjo, and they'd be having a good old time. But, of course, that was through the 60s when, obviously, they'd won their first premiership in 61. So, yeah, and then again, when I got older and, of course, became sort of vice-captain and captain, then, of course, it was up to us to pass the baton on to the younger players that were coming through. And, of course, I guess as we all saw in the mid-90s, and Daniel was probably around there at that time, maybe a tad later, that, of course, the club could have folded. And, again, great people stepped in and saved the club. And, of course, now we're probably the most successful club for the last 20, 25 years. So, again, being able to stay within a system, being able to enjoy one another's company, the chemistry, the camaraderie, the closeness, and I think that helps a lot to stay within a system that gives you success, and that's what all the Hawthorn boys want to do.
Yeah, I mean, you were so lucky to have so many amazing athletes around you through that period of time. Is there one that stands out for you? If you were to pick one, who was the best player that you played with at Hawthorn?
Oh, that's pretty difficult, Sherelle. There might be a few of the boys listening to this early in the morning because of COVID.
They all love the show, Izzy.
That's right. I love them all, and I just love playing with those group of boys who went through that time in the late 70s to early 90s. But I guess if I was playing in finals and grand finals, which we're lucky enough to do over a long period of time, probably one of the big-time players for me would have been Dermot Brereton. And we know how tough Dermot was and the things that he had to go through to play games. And, of course, the 89 grand final stands out with him being poleaxed in the first 10 seconds, basically, and Dipper and all the other guys that paid the price. But I'd probably say Dermot, but that's not certainly in any way showing disrespect to all the other boys that I played with because, as you said, Sherelle, I did play with some mighty superstars of the Hawthorn Football Club, and we wouldn't have been that good if those guys all weren't coming through at the same time. And obviously, we're also able to add players along the way, you know, selective recruiting. Jason Dunstall was a superstar. You know, Darren Pritchard, Johnny Platton, one of the best small players that ever played the game, especially for Hawthorn, obviously. Chucky, superstar in longevity. But there are other guys that played their roles as well. So, all in all, I was pretty lucky to be part of that great side.
And that the start of that great side was sort of in 83, in which the first year you really played most of the season. You played 36 games in your first 5 years, and 83 years you played 18, including the win over Essendon in the grand final. It was the first of seven grand finals in a row, which is just ridiculous when you think about it. Did you realise at that time that there would be a dynasty coming your way, that the team and the coach was so tight and so good that it would survive that period of time, or was it just enjoying the moment while it was there?
No, I thought we were assembling a pretty good team, Daniel. It was probably started in 82 and were able to then sort of just get that, I guess, group of guys that were starting off together. And don't forget John Kennedy Jr. and Peter Schwab and Chris Mew and, of course, Dermot, as I mentioned before. And then you had the likes of Chris Langford coming through. And, of course, Hawthorn didn't play finals 79, 80 and 81, which was very unusual considering, as I said before, about the amount of finals and then what we're able to lead into. So I thought we were getting a pretty good side together. And when Alan Jeans came to the club, he was a coach that gave me enormous confidence. And I think that's the thing that we do sometimes as a coach. We can probably take confidence away from individuals, and we don't mean to do that, but you know, we can make players play in positions that are foreign to them. So we need to arm them with all the right mental attributes to be able to go on and play footy and realise their potential. It takes a lot of hard work, as we know, but once Alan Jeans came to the club, Daniel, I thought we were on the right track, and of course it ended up showing that. But hey, we won 83, as you mentioned, and I did find out pretty early on in footy, though, it's a great leveller, and I know we're talking about my first game, but we played Richmond the following week. I sat on the interchange bench again, got two kicks, and then got the flick the following week. So that's how quickly things can change. And obviously, 83, we won and won well. It was a great feeling to win your first premiership, because that's what all young players or any VFL, AFL player aspires to. But then we lost 84 and 85 to those dirty mugs, Essendon, Daniel. So we had the right to win in 86, which we did. So, yeah, very, very thankful, mate.
Today we get into the sanctum of the Magpies. Taylor Adams is our very good friend in the black and the white, and he's back again with us. Good morning, Taylor.
Good morning, Half. How are you?
I'm going well. I'm very, very well. You are now in Queensland after being in Perth. What is your current situation? Are you in just a quarantine, or are you good to go after coming back from Perth?
No, we're after quarantine up here. We've entered the AFL hub. So we're staying at the same resort as North Melbourne and the Demons, and yeah, luckily for us, we don't have to quarantine. So we're sort of free to live by the AFL restricted guidelines that are pretty similar to stage three down in Melbourne. So that no restaurants and cafes, just takeaway food. You know, try to stay away from shopping centres unless it's essential. So. Yeah, it's nice to be up here, mate. It's been great the last couple of days.
Will you be playing tennis?
Not with anyone outside of the AFL bubble. But I haven't sussed out if there's a tennis court here. I know there's a golf course, and I'm looking forward to jumping on that at some stage.
Just a little sneaky one early doors, Tay. Well played. Well backhanded down the line there for a winner from you. How disappointing was the performance on the weekend against Fremantle? Was it? Do you think it's one that might come back to haunt you?
They're all disappointing when you lose, and in a shortened season, they're probably worth more the wins and losses. So, yeah, we were outplayed by Fremantle. We've been outplayed the last couple of weeks. I think our destiny is still completely in our hands. We've got plenty of footy left in the season, and we've shown throughout parts of the year that we can, you know, when we put our best football together, we're pretty hard to beat. So, it's almost impossible to project forward and work out whether or not that's going to have an impact on our season. But that would probably be inefficient of us. We're sort of, you know, we've had 4 days to decompress, or 3 days to decompress, and we've got today to get ready for Sydney. So we're facing something we've never faced before. We've travelled across the country, and we're playing back-to-back games in four-day breaks. So not a lot of time to dwell. We're looking forward to getting back out there tomorrow night and hopefully putting in a better performance.
How are the confidence levels? Because it is now four of the last six you've lost, but you've also played some good footy in that six-week period as well. And there's that extra layer of the fact that the last 2 weeks you've played against West Coast and Freo in Perth, which is never easy to win, regardless of where they sit on the ladder, particularly when they've got their home crowd behind them. So how do you assess where you're at, and how are the confidence levels?
Yeah, we've taken a pretty methodical approach. I think it's just really coming back to what we know works. You know, analysing how we played against what we know we can produce, and what we know in the past has been positive for us. There's no doubt after a couple of games, especially when you're in the early part of your career, you do start to wonder if you're up to the standard. But our job as leaders and as coaches is to reassure all the guys playing that we are good enough, and what they bring to the team when they play in role and play for the team, then that can be a real attribute for us. And we've spent the last couple of days going over a lot of vision. Obviously, we don't have the option to train this week and get better on the track, so we're trying to find other ways to do that off the track. And yeah, I think it's been a relatively positive week. Like, as I said, there's no real chance to dwell on it. We've had two bad games in a row, and yeah, that's the reality of it. There's plenty of footy left, and we're looking forward to getting out there tomorrow night.
Is there any one thing that you've been able to isolate or notice yourself as one of the leaders and one of the key players in the midfield that's been lacking the last couple of weeks? I mean, Scott Pendlebury is obviously the first thing that comes to mind from a leadership perspective and ball in hand, but is there anything you think, oh, gee, we can fix that really quite quickly and that'll help us propel into this next phase of the season?
Well, I think it probably starts with what's happening around the ball at the moment. There's, the numbers were pretty stark on the weekend where we were smacked at contested possession, clearance, ground ball, and our tackling numbers were probably the lowest they've been in a while. So our brand of football is built off the back of pressure, contest and pressure. And, you know, if we don't bring that, we all of a sudden even up the playing field for teams. And, Fremantle and West Coast have both brought the pressure against us over the last fortnight. And we probably haven't handled that as well as we have in the past. No doubt Pendles is a huge out. You know, he's a class act and a great leader. But the thing that we've done well as a football club is we've played as a group, united group, a team, not just relying on, one or two players, whether it be Howie, Pendles, Steele or Geordie, who we've missed over the last month. You know, we rely on 22 guys going out there and playing their role and contributing to the team. And that's what has made us hard to beat over the last couple of years. And we know that. We're pretty keen to get back out there. We know that our best footy's not too far away. We feel like it's just a matter of time. We there's a few things we can clean up pretty quickly, and we look forward to doing that.
Nathan Buckley, Daniel sort of joked about it earlier with the tennis situation. Did it rock him? Did he feel he had to address the group about it? Did it rattle him? Did it affect the team at all? What was your views on it all?
I'm not sure if it rattled him. He seemed pretty, when he was able to address the group, he seemed pretty calm. Obviously really apologetic that he put the club in that position and put us in that position. But from my point of view, although it was a breach of what the AFL have put in place, I think in the scheme of things, what we've dealt with this year, guys leaving families and uprooting their lives, it was a pretty minor issue. I don't think it had any impact on our performance on the weekend. I just think that, these things happen. It just goes to show that the man's human. He's made a mistake. He's put his hand up for it. Like Brenton and Nathan both made a mistake, and they've both put their hand up for it. And we move on. It's as simple as that. That's one thing Bucks has done really well. In my time at the club, is he doesn't judge you off the back of one incident, and I'm sure the playing group won't do that to him.
I need to look at John Quinn, because he's Quinn Elite Sports. He's saving lives at the moment with the quintessential regime we've got on the website, the Breakfast Club page on the rsn.net.au website. Saving lives he is. Quinny, good morning.
Good morning. Actually, I was just talking to Joey before I came on air, and the way he's talking, I'm taking his life. You reckon
he's killing him? Yeah, well, that's right.
Well, that's Whitey's concern as well. Whitey, what were you talking about before the break?
Now, well, I've got this plan, John, which I think you should be proud of me. At half time in the football, I'm doing that circuit thing that you've set up. So it's 20 minutes or 25 minutes, and then that's my aim now for this footy frenzy, that at half time in every game, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I really struggled to watch the second half of the footy last night because I could hardly move.
Well, you're blaming me for that. Well, look, I reckon that's...
No, I'm blaming myself. I'm actually blaming myself.
It gets you into a routine, and routine's the most important thing here. So once you just set the alarm clock or whatever it is, half-time in the footy, and get started. But you probably need to start to increase the volume a little bit more than the 25 minutes once you get used to that. After a month or so, let's get it up to 30 minutes, 35. So maybe do it until halfway through the third quarter. But anyway, at least you're off and going. That's the main thing.
But I think the point you make, John, is the best one, is that it becomes part of your routine. And if you just know that's when you're going to do it, I've sort of got my head around the fact that's what's happening, and it's actually working quite well. It's like, you go for your walk. If you pick a time during the day and say, all right, that's the time I'm going to do it, particularly in a lockdown situation, you just make yourself do it, and it becomes a bit of a habit. And I've almost got to that point after 3.5 weeks.
Look, the big thing is, if I've got a diary that's just full of appointments and bookings and things like that, and we don't make appointments to see ourselves. And we're the most important people we know. You've got to make time for yourself to get fit, to stay healthy, to relax, whatever it might be. Make an appointment in your diary for yourself today is my advice.
Sherelle, make sure you do that today. What about, Quinny, just we were talking to Taylor Adams before the break from the Magpies, and he was talking about how difficult it is for coaches with these short turnarounds in games. I imagine from a high-performance perspective, just outside of our regime for a second, it would be very, very challenging getting these athletes back up and firing to 100% 3 or 4 days after one game to play the next.
It goes, I think, beyond incredibly hard to impossible. I don't really think you can get the players back to full recovery. When you play a game of AFL, it's going to take a good 3 days, 4 days before the players even recover enough to get back into training. We've got turnarounds happening now 4 or 5 days, and we're putting them back to back to back to back. It's inevitable what's going to happen here, and that is that you're going to see an increase in soft tissue injury, and you're going to see an increase in games getting slower. So games are going to just get, they're going to drag down and down as players just drag them through themselves through the end of a game.
Well, Quinny, that's the physical side of it, and there'll certainly be challenges there getting everyone back up and going, but there's the mental side of it as well, and the review process that those elite athletes go through when they're looking forward to the next game. I mean, it's going to be a lot to fit in a really short period of time, isn't it? And I guess teams will have to adjust how they go about that process.
Oh, it's huge. And I think you talk about that mental process. The coaches have tried to move on that pretty quickly, like they do that the day straight after the game to give the players as much downtime as they can. But so anybody thinking that the players are living up on the Gold Coast or wherever they might be and having a great time, that's not how it's working. They're in a bubble and they're out of their normal routine. Like when you go home after training, you don't go back to your bedroom and lie on your bed and look at TV. That's about what all they've got to do in these hotels that they're in. So it's changing the whole routine of what they would normally do, and I think that's really important. And you know, lying on that bed's different to the one that they'd normally have at home, and it's okay for a day or two, but we're talking about week upon week upon week, elite athletes trying to recover for a maximum effort of a game. They're not even sleeping properly, and then they're in these hotels, a night out having a different meal is okay, but eating hotel food again day after day is not that great for recovery. There's so many factors here that's impacting on performance. And, you know, my hat's off to them for giving it a crack, but I fear for a lot of these players in terms of the injuries that are going to start coming, and I think it'll start happening over this next... Well, it's already happening, but it'll start to increase in the next 2 weeks, because 3 to 4 weeks is about the time when that lack of recovery is going to really bite.
One of the guns from Port Adelaide, who was very, very impressive the other night in the kickoff of round 10 as the Power defeated the Bulldogs by 13 points at the Adelaide Oval. Tom Rockliffe is his name. He joins us. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. How are we, gentlemen?
We're going very well, thank you, buddy. Nice to have you on board. One of the stars of the show the other night, you were. 15 tackles, Tom. What are you doing, man?
Oh, no. Second of the ball. Too much. And had to tackle. No, it's a bit the way the Bulldogs play that game of making it contest to contest. So we knew that it was going to be a little bit like that, and we had to be bringing our best contested work around that, and I thought we did as the night wore on. We were a bit scrappy early on in the game, but once we settled into it, I think we got better as the game went on.
Are there teams, you mentioned the Bulldogs, that's the way they play, and you have to get yourself ready for that. Are there many teams in the competition where you those little nuances you have to really focus on before you get into the game, in the build-up to the game, rather than just going out and playing your game against theirs?
Yeah, a little bit. I think you want to try and play your brand of footy as best you can, but you know that there's going to be variances in that, and opposition's clearly one of them. So I think Richmond's another one that has played that type of style for the last couple of years of just a territory game and making sure they just get the knock-ons and get the ball forward and playing front half footy. So it's a focus of ours as well to play front half footy. So I think coming up against them on Saturday night, it's a really good opportunity for us to test our game against one of the best in the competition.
15 tackles is 60 points, Daniel, in Dream Team, our fantasy football. 123 points from Tom, 110 the week before. Thank you very much. Hey, Tom, I wanted to firstly congratulations on your return to form, because It was only a couple of weeks ago you were left out of the team. I'm just interested, because that wouldn't happen to you too often over your career, how you handled that and how strongly you've come back as a result of that. Take us through that challenging little period.
Yeah, it was obviously disappointing. We had that loss to Brisbane and clearly wasn't at my best, and we were probably carrying one too many inside midfielders. And when you don't get your game going and you don't play that brand of footy and win the footy inside, you leave yourselves open. And I definitely wasn't on top of my game. And Kenny gave him a tap on the shoulder and said, "We're going to leave you out this week." And then as it sort of progressed, I missed two or three games. And so I just had to work through that. It's obviously a tricky time as well with no reserves footy to play. We had a 15-on-15 scratch match against the Crows, which I felt like I needed, and a bit of a hit out against them, and got my hands going and made sure I was clean inside. And then coming back into the team, that's what I've really focused on, is to make sure that I'm one touch. I think anyone that's ever watched me play has seen that I'm not going to be the one that's running down the wing having three bounces. I just can't run that way compared to other players. So I've got to make sure that I'm setting them up and get the ball to the outside and play to my strengths as a player. And that is how I see the game, and making sure that I organise and set our stoppages up the way we want to play, and make sure that we're in complete control around those stoppages, and then set the runners up on the outside. And I felt like I've been able to do that the last couple of games, come back in, and I think as a whole midfield unit, we've been really good in that area the last 2 weeks, where we let ourselves down the week before. So I've just got to continue to do that, make sure that I'm clean inside, and then obviously hitting targets and sort of not the long 50-metre passes or anything like that, but just making sure that we control the speed of the game and play it on our terms instead of the opposition, and making sure that I use the footy well.
I mean, that's a fascinating insight. And I mean, someone like yourself who has been such a consistent player over such a long period of time, could you put your finger on what changed, or was it just circumstantial? I mean, obviously, all of you are playing under such unique circumstances at the moment that form, I'm sure, can be lost pretty quickly. Was it a mental thing? What would you put it down to? Because you've bounced back so strongly.
Yeah, it's hard. It's a hard one. I think everyone goes through it. There's no doubt about that. Your form goes up and down, and obviously you want to play the best you can every game, but realistically you can't do that. And I probably had a week or two where it just wasn't at the level where it needed to be. And when you're winning games of footy, there's pressure on spots. There's no doubt about that. And as I said before, there's no reserves footy, but we feel like we've got a really good squad, and anyone can step in and play a role for us. And you've just got to make sure that you're getting the job done. And we're in a really good position at the moment, sitting where we want to sit on the ladder, and we want to stay there. So you've got to make sure that you perform week in, week out. You don't want to give the coaches an opportunity to push you out of the team. And I unfortunately did that earlier in the year, and it was probably a good thing looking back now, because I realised how important it is, and making sure that I get my job done week in, week out. Well, not even week in, week out, I suppose, game in, game out, because you'll be playing every 3 or 4 days at the moment. So you've just got to make sure that you're on top of your game as best you can, and rely on each other and your teammates to work hard. And we've been able to do that. I think if you've watched our games this season, when we've played our best footy, we've had a really good even spread across the whole team. Yeah, we've had guys that have played probably a little bit better, Travis Bogue, Charlie Dixon in different games, Robbie Gray, but across the board, I think we've had a really good even spread from our defenders, midfielders and forwards.
I know Peter Siddle loves Marsha Brady, because everyone did back in the day, and he is probably thinking about her right now in quarantine in Tassie in a hotel. Not sure what else he's doing, but he joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, boys.
Did you like Marsha, Jan or Cindy?
Oh, mate, I think I was a bit too young to even worry about her. She's turning 64. Jesus Christ.
Surely you watched the Brady Bunch.
Nah.
Really?
That was well before me. Come on, guys. I'm only 35.
Yeah, I didn't watch it either. Yeah, but I'm a bit older
serious?
Than Pete. But I didn't like that. That was rubbish. I didn't watch
that. You blokes. Get a life, you blacks. Goodness me. And we can actually say that to you, Peter, these days, because you're sitting in the quarantine hotel. You need to get a life. How are you tracking?
Yeah, I'm going all right. It's the
it's the morning of day 11, so ticking along quite nicely. Not doing too bad.
What can you do in quarantine in Tassie? What's your life look like day to day?
Well, I'm still in bed. I don't leave the bed much. And the best thing about being in quarantine and sleeping more than normal, you can't get in trouble. Like, it's the best thing to do.
Great result.
But I've been doing a lot of reading, bit of Netflix, NBA basketball's back, football at night. So there's been enough to pass the time.
So you're not bored yet. You're going okay. You sound pretty upbeat with only 3 days to go.
Oh, I think that's why I am upbeat. Knowing I've only got a couple of days to go, but it's been all right. Like I said, it's got to be done. And, you know, as long as you find something to do and enough things to pass the day, that, you get through.
How are you feeling? Obviously you're not out of the quarantine yet, but has reality hit yet that you've left Victoria and you're heading down to the Apple Isle?
A little bit. I think probably more so, I reckon, once I am out, and I can go and meet up with the boys and then obviously the group and everything like that. I think that's when it'll hit home. So probably on Monday it becomes reality then when I rock up to my first training day and meet everyone and, start my career again at a new state. So I think, putting on different tracksuit will feel a little bit different at first.
Now, we go to all of Tasmania, not just here in Victoria. So I know there's a lot of people listening that are very excited that you are joining Tasmania. Take us through, your living arrangements, I guess, because there was some talk at one point that you may have lived in Victoria and played for Tassie and all these sorts of things. Tell us exactly what you're actually going to do.
When I'm obviously in Tasmania, I'm in Tasmania. I think, people got a bit misunderstood when it was first discussed. The fact that I won't be down here however lot was just the fact that I play for the Adelaide Strikers, so over the next couple of years I'll be flying out to Adelaide to join them. I've still got a contract with Essex over in England, so then I'll leave for 6 months in winter here to play over there. So I think that's, when I'm in Tassie, I'm here permanently. I do jet set off and join other teams at different stages, which will take me away from the state. But, wholeheartedly, once I'm here, I'm all in, and I'll be doing everything I can to win games for Tassie.
There's so many good fast bowlers in Tasmania at the moment, and the two that sort of stand out to me is obviously Riley Meredith for his pace and even maybe some like Gabe Bell for his ability to move the ball in the air, but there's others as well. Who is the one that you're looking forward to spending most time with? Is there one that stands out?
I think, like you said, the whole group, because, they do have an exciting young bunch of fast bowlers that, are starting out and looking to develop and play and represent Tasmania. But I think someone who reminds me a little bit of myself when I was young, energetic and just charged in, and young Nathan Ellis, I think, we all got to see a lot of him in the Big Bash, and then he finished the season strong in his first taste of Shield cricket. And I just think, he just charges in fast and just tries the bowl sort of as quick as he can, bit of skill. That excites me. I think, just seeing him having a crack last year, that's a good story, where it comes from Sydney and then struggled down here. So I think, it's going to be exciting working with the whole group. But I'm looking forward to, obviously working alongside him.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.